Well, if you joined us today, I guess you've caught on now that we have been working through the Jacob story. And this is, I think this is about week seven, I think. So there's a lot of story behind us now, and this week and one more week to go. And in many ways, it is crunch time for Jacob. Because the moment that has been on the horizon for him for basically 20 years is about to finally arrive. He's going to have to meet his brother, Esau, who he stole this blessing from, and who in return wanted him dead. That's why he fled 20 years ago. And so Jacob's kind of return home, and his whole future depends on how this next day or two goes. And in chapter 32, and verses kind of the first big chunk of verses up to chapter verse 1 to 21, I think Jacob goes through what is a familiar, well-worn experience for anyone who's walked with God. He's a whole mixed bag of emotions. What do you do? How do you feel when big things are looming? You know, something that you've been really nervous about, or maybe something that you're dreading. How do you process that? You know, can you put yourselves in Jacob's shoes? As he sends off these messengers at the start of the chapter, and he's very unsure about what message they're going to return with from Esau. You know, like that moment where you send an email, you nervously wait for the reply, and sometimes I certainly do this, the reply comes and you see it in your inbox and you can't quite bring yourself to open it and read it yet because you're a bit worried about what it might say. How do you respond in those circumstances as someone who knows God, who knows God's presence with you? You know, just like Jacob had God's presence with him, even more so for us today, the Holy Spirit living in us, we've got his sure promises. Do you respond anything like Jacob to those nervous, anxious moments? He's a real mixed bag. So first of all, there's fearful panic. Verses 6 to 8, let me read those again for us. When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to meet your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." That doesn't sound good, does it? In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds and camels as well. He thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape. He's thinking, surely disaster is about to fall upon us. He's flailing around. He's trying to like salvage something. You know, if we split in two, maybe some of us can survive. Jacob despairs, fearful panic. But then he pauses and we get this really faithful prayer. Verses 9 to 12. Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, 'Go back to your country and your relatives and I'll make you prosper,' I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you've shown your servant. I don't need my staff when I cross this Jordan, but now I've become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I'm afraid he'll come and attack me and also the mothers with their children. But you've said, 'I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.'" It's a brilliant prayer, isn't it? He prays in faith to the God who has walked with his family for three generations. To the God who has promised that he is going to get him home safely. To the God who has shown him so much kindness and faithfulness in the past. The God who has proved his character to Jacob. Jacob pleads with this God to deliver him. He names and claims his promises. It's a wonderful, faithful prayer. So we've got fearful panic. We've got faithful prayer. And then from verse 13, Jacob also does some fast planning. He comes up with this elaborate idea to send wave after wave of animals, basically to placate Esau. What do you make of that? Is that Jacob falling back into fearful panic? Is this Jacob failing to trust the God that he's literally just prayed to? Or is it just Jacob being sensible? You know, being practical, not over-spiritualizing things, recognizing that God has made us to make decisions, and so he's kind of doing what he thinks is right in that situation. Which is it? I'm not sure that the text kind of sends us decisively either way. Isn't that life? You've got this situation. You said you've kind of got to do something. You're not quite sure what the right thing is to do. Sometimes you're doing something and you think, oh, it feels like maybe this isn't the right thing to do. Isn't that what life is so often like? It's a step back, different circumstances. But does this have any resonance with you and your walk with God? Fear and faith all kind of mixed up together. Doubt and devotion, often daily bedfellows, tagging in and out on a regular basis. Well, if you identify with any of that in those first 21 verses, the great thing is nowhere is Jacob rebuked. Now, this passage isn't written to rebuke us for our wobbliness in faith. God understands what we're like, what we're susceptible to. And yet at the same time, this passage shows us that God's desire is that our experience would be one of more steadfast faith and devotion in him. And so come back to Jacob. How does God encourage and embolden Jacob? What has the writer of Genesis got for us and our wobbly hearts? Well, we get this really surprising episode, don't we? Fairly unique, even in the Bible. Previous church I was in, and there was an apprentice at the church, and he was really into wrestling. He loved this passage, his favourite passage in the Bible. It's a crazy passage, isn't it? But one actually that shows us clearly God is all about strengthening the faith of his people. He's all about growing us into genuine, robust faith that is built on the right sort of foundation and that is able to survive all sorts of trials. The first thing we see here from verse 22 is that God initiates. You know, this isn't a kind of bigger, better faith that we're supposed to somehow summon up from within ourselves. What a relief that is, hey? No, God is the one here with Jacob who sees this kind of wobbliness, and then God takes the initiative to help Jacob take a step forward in growth. So the reckoning with Esau is imminent. Jacob, he sends all, even his family, just away across the river, and then he plans this night of solitude. And I guess if God hadn't intervened, well, the night would have gone somewhat like the day did. There would be moments of just panic. There would have been moments of prayer and dependence on God. Maybe there would have even been some rewrites of the strategy for what he was going to do the next day. There he is. He's planning this night of solitude, and then he's literally smacked down. I'd love to try and picture this scene. You know, it's dark. Maybe he's on his knees. He is praying at this point, and then bam. He's winded. Like the two of these figures, they wrestle all through the night. It is a proper royal rumble. Wrestling all through the night. I mean, we were left with so many questions, aren't we? So many questions. But as the account unfolds, it is clear that this is God wrestling with Jacob. It's God wrestling with Jacob. Yeah, how is it that God has taken on the form of a man here? I don't really know. And people speak about the angel of the Lord who pops up occasionally in the Old Testament. And some people suggest this is Jesus here, but the incarnation hasn't happened yet, and so Jesus doesn't have a human body, so I'm not sure that really helps us. We don't actually need to know exactly who this is. Jacob is clear by the end of it. It is God himself who is wrestling with him. God's not distant. He's up close and personal. He's got work to do with Jacob for Jacob's good. And Jacob, well, as they grapple all night, he refuses to tap out. He refuses. He's the weaker partner in this wrestling match, but he refuses to tap out. Even when the man touches his hip and leaves it injured and presumably in great pain, Jacob refuses to give in. There's no other details reported. Maybe this went on for hours, I don't know, until we're told the sun is about to rise. And then the man says, "Let me go, because it's daybreak." I think he's thinking of Jacob at this point, you know, because as soon as the sun rises, well, Jacob is going to be in danger, isn't he? Because as we've been thinking about, God is holy. In the Old Testament, you can't look at the holy God and live. And so this man needs to be gone sharpish for Jacob's sake. And yet, even though he's warned to let go, what does Jacob do? This is where Jacob really grows. His response there in verse 26, Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He is determined to cling on to God. Despite the danger, the early glow of sunlight on the horizon, he just refuses to let go. Because he knows God's blessing is so worth it. Now, what a great picture we're given here of faith, the kind of faith that God is drawing out of Jacob, clinging to God. And I think of our girls and their vice-like grip on, you know, any toy or particular colour of pen that they don't want to let go of, they refuse to let go of. That's the image here. You know, who knew that stubbornness was such a commendable trait in the Christian life? Refusing to let go. God initiates, Jacob clings on. That is the Christian life. You know, that's how the Christian life began, isn't it? God called us. God committed himself to us. He kick-started our life of faith. And so now in the Christian life, how encouraged, remember, you know, we're not trying to sustain something that we got up and running in the first place. Now, the God who initiated our faith also takes responsibility for sustaining it. And sometimes, like with Jacob, that looks like bringing us to a place where all we can do is just cling on. And if that's all we can do, well, then that's enough. And the prophet Hosea, later in the Old Testament, he picks up on this incident and he speaks of Jacob weeping and begging for God's favour. Weeping and begging for God's favour. You know, how easy it is, isn't it, to have a sanitised view of faith, that mature faith is unemotional and it's stoical and it's middle class. That's not what God draws out of Jacob here. This person stubbornly clinging on to God is the one who's doing it right. True faith is not, it's not being strong in and of yourself. It is showing that we get God is worth it. He's my only hope. I'm not going to let go. God initiates. Jacob clings on. And then here's the really wonderful bit. Grace overflows. Grace overflows. Jacob, he won't let go. He insists on this blessing. And verse 29, he gets the blessing. You know, the man who refused to tap out is given the blessing he asked for. We saw more of that blessing and that overflow of grace in the conversation and that happens between them about names. So in verse 27, the man asks him, what is your name? Not because he doesn't know it. Remember, this is God. God knows exactly who it is that he's, you know, wrestling in the dark. But I think he asks it because it forced Jacob to fess up to who he is and what he's done. And my name's Jacob, heel grabber, blessing stealer. Remember, that's what his name means? But then comes the wave of overflowing grace. Verse 28, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Isn't it amazing? A picture of forgiveness and transformation, being freed from being defined by his past. In and of himself, Jacob is such unpromising material. Can God really do anything with him? Does God want to do anything with him? Yes. Yes, he does. Jacob recognizes by verse 29, he shouldn't have even survived this encounter with the living God, let alone come out of it well. But this name change, it sees God doubling down on that promise to make Jacob the channel of all of his future plans to bless the whole world. So God's done proper business with Jacob. Fight night is over. And now he's ready to meet his brother. I'm going to read just the first few verses of chapter 33. And we will see how the grace keeps flowing. We'll see a Jacob who's slightly more confident because he's met God. But ultimately, above all, we'll see that the grace from God just keeps on flowing. Other key thing to remember if I read this, remember Esau is this big, hairy, scary, slightly wild man. And the last time Jacob saw him, he wanted Jacob dead. Okay? This is what happens. Chapter 33. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground seven times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They're the children God has graciously given your servant." Then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What's the meaning of all these flocks and herds that I met?" "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob, "if I found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you've received me favorably. Please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. God has completely softened Esau, hasn't he? You know, this figure that Jacob had feared for 20 years just runs to him and embraces him and kisses him. Jacob, he persists with his groveling references to himself as your servant. But Esau just responds, verse 9, "My brother." It's not even that all these gifts of the animals that wins his favor. Esau actually isn't interested in the animals. He's just glad to see his brother again. He wants to be introduced to his wife, the wives and the kids. You know, "Let me meet my nephews." Do you see, under God's hand of blessing, this dreaded meeting goes far, far better than Jacob ever dreamed of. Esau's willing to move on from the past. It is real reconciliation. How high or low is your bar for what God could do with any given situation? How much do you realize that he is able to just turn things on their head, just like that? I think of a friend who's battling with cancer at the moment, crying out to the Lord and seeing answers to prayer that are surprising everyone. They shared recently about an operation that they were about to have, and they said this in an email. They said, "This is surgery that only a few months back the medical team didn't think would be possible, which at the time was very hard news. However, the Lord has heard our prayers, and in his immense grace and kindness has now brought me to a point where I can have the surgery. The medical team are quite astounded. I still can't believe it after nearly a year of uncertainty. I hope this news encourages you as it has me. I'm so thankful for all who've prayed for us, and we praise God for this answer he's given." How high or low is your bar for what God could do? As we cling to God, he is powerful to intervene. But even when he doesn't, as we would like him to, in a particular situation, well, the overflow of grace doesn't stop, because for us, there is one gracious intervention, more important than any other, that has already happened. And it is, I think, foreshadowed also in this passage. I think incredibly that Esau is the figure who is foreshadowing what God does for all of us in the gospel. Jacob recognizes something of this in verse 10 when he says, "For seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. Now you've received me favorably." He recognizes there are some parallels actually between how Esau is acting and how God acts. Do you see it too here? The running and embracing and throwing the arms around his neck and kissing him. Isn't that very like the father in Jesus' parable about the prodigal son? The father, of course, who stands for God
and the way he receives back the one who'd done so much wrong, the sort of gospel welcome that we've all received from God.
Also, isn't this foreshadowing the fact that reconciliation doesn't depend on us having first to buy favor from the one that we've wronged? You know, just as Esau won't accept those gifts, says, I don't need the gifts. Or at least he doesn't accept the gifts until right at the end when he's made it clear that accepting the gifts is nothing to do with his accepting of Jacob. That's what God's done for us, isn't it? Reconciliation with him given freely, without a price that we have to pay. Just come. So I think we see here, in the context of Jesus' ultimate fulfillment, we see a reminder, an amazing reminder of how God really has powerfully intervened for every single one of us on our behalf, how he's already flooded our lives with grace, truly forgiven and welcomed us back to him. Let's not lose the wonder of that. You know, as you're surprised by Esau here, wow, surprising that Esau acts like that. That's not what I'd expect. Well, let's stop being surprised by God. Well, God really shouldn't act like that, but he has. He's welcomed us back. He said we don't need to pay anything. He'll just have us back. So as we draw to a close, lots of themes in this passage, aren't there? A couple of questions just to finish with. Firstly, do you expect God to deal personally, up close and intimate with you? Do you expect God to do that, to deal with you personally? I think here, as you know, Jacob takes on this name Israel, he clearly is standing for the whole people of God. As we look at Jacob, we can kind of see all the whole people of God, everyone who will follow him, even the Gentiles are eventually going to be grafted in. And so what God does with him, I think we should expect God to do the same with us, as we're now part of this people of God. Probably not in the form of a literal wrestling match, but particular intentional involvement with each of us in order to grow and strengthen our faith in ways that he knows best. Do you expect God to be involved in your life like that? Do you welcome it? And then final question, posed for us by verse 31. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Does your view of God's gracious, transformative work in your life allow him the space to give you a limp? Think of Jacob. No surgeons there to properly reset his hip. It's likely, I guess, that Jacob limped from that day forward. He carried this ever-present reminder of that time when God came and wrestled with him. A reminder that he ought not to have been spared, but nonetheless, he clung on and he was treated with such grace. Does your view of God's gracious, transformative work in your life allow him to give you a limp? I want to be careful applying this, you know, straight over to us, because we can never tell God's exact intention in any given situation. But maybe there are experiences that you've been through that have had lasting effects. You're left with physical or more often emotional scars, limps. And yet maybe those same events also undeniably brought you closer to God. Maybe they were the times where actually you really learnt to cling to him and refuse to let go, where you learnt his true worth. Maybe a time like that brought you to him in the first place. You see, God doesn't waste any pain that we go through. Limping in the Christian life is not a bad thing. God might be using that limp, and of course the experience that sits behind it, the past experience that sits behind it, God might be using that to keep us clinging to him, just like with Jacob and his limp. So don't despise the limp, and don't despise leaders who limp. You know, Jacob, as he leads his family in these later years of his life, helped by the fact that he had this experience and he now limps. Paul and his thorn in the flesh. Charles Spurgeon battling with huge doubts of bouts of depression. John Piper losing his mum in a car crash. Hard times shape leaders. You know, the worldly view would say, wouldn't it, avoid vulnerable leaders. Avoid them. But the gospel lens say, actually, there's nothing quite like being pointed to Jesus by people who've been forced to cling on themselves. So let's strive to be a church where strength and maturity is measured as much as anything else by stubborn clinging onto God. Where it's okay for anyone to limp and not feel like they have to hide that. And where we never cease to be amazed by the overflow of grace that keeps coming to us as we belong to the Lord Jesus.